Welcome to the Disney Magic Podcast. My name is Joel Leonard.
And I'm Megan.
And we like Disney things. Specifically this week, we like taking a look at Fantasia.
Yep.
Fantasia was Mr. Walt Disney's third feature in his Walt Disney Animated Classic series. It came out in 1940, specifically November 13th, 1940, right after Pinocchio, because Pinocchio came out the same year.
Yeah, wow.
So it was a busy year for him.
Multitasking.
And it's an interesting Disney movie. It's very different than every other Disney movie before it, and pretty much since it, other than,
you know, Fantasia, obviously Fantasia 2000. You know, that movie that kind of is the same.
Yeah, the other Fantasia movie. But, like before, we're gonna pretty much go through the whole movie, but I wanted to take a second and talk about the ideas that were behind creating this movie, because I think it's just a really interesting story, because it is such a different movie than any of the other ones. It's got a different backstory than, I want to make that movie a cartoon, which is, you know, kind of the backstory for a lot of them.
Yeah.
But Fantasia was spawned from the idea of the Silly Symphony shorts that Walt Disney made for Mickey Mouse and for Goofy and for Donald Duck.
Right, right.
And the idea was kind of to create the ultimate Silly Symphony. And basically, it was the Sorcerer's Apprentice would be this Silly Symphony opus ultimatum. And would also be a revival for the character of Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse was kind of not as popular as Donald Duck or as Goofy at the time.
That's so funny to me. That's so weird to think about.
Like, because he's the Disney icon. Yep. And so, but he is, I don't think he's as fun to audiences sometimes, because he's this happy-go-lucky, everything works out, chucks and a giggle kind of character.
That's true.
Whereas Donald just,
is really
like,
funny.
he just goes crazy on everything and overacts,
and
yeah.
Goofy's just so, you know, goofy.
They're such cartoon characters, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas Mickey does often play the straight man between
the
three of them, so.
And it was interesting, there was talk when they were talking about doing it right after the success of Snow White, to put Dopey into this role of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, I can see that.
I was like, when I heard about it, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I could see them doing that. But Walt was really adamant about this being a comeback for Mickey Mouse and being Mickey Mouse's thing. And there was pretty much a chance meeting with Leopold Stokowski, who ended up doing the music, conducting the orchestra for Fantasia, and Walt Disney, you know, kind of just met him and had dinner with him and mentioned this idea for doing The Sorcerer's Apprentice as a Silly Symphony. And Stokowski was like, I'd really like to conduct that for you. And at the time, Stokowski was the conductor in America.
Yeah.
He was this huge guy, and so when he says that, Walt Disney says, yes, right away, we're doing that.
Yes, please, happens now.
And so we're going to make this work. And it built from that. They were making this, and it was such an expensive endeavor to bring in Stokowski and, you know, bring in this huge
full
bit
orchestra.
Of classical work, full orchestra. There were records that it was going to cost about three times what a Silly Symphony should cost.
Mm-hmm.
And Walt Disney's brother, Roy, who was doing a lot of the expense reports and books
right.
at the time, was, you know, knocking on me like, this can't happen. This is not Silly Symphony prices. We'll never, ever, ever come close to making back our money on this one. And rather than being like, all right, I guess we can't do this, let's shut it down, Walt's answer was, let's make more then.
We will make all of them. Go.
This is the movie version we're going to make. And it developed into Fantasia and creating this entire film experience of, you know, film and music and symphony.
Yeah.
And so
I think it's really, really neat. I think it's one of the most interesting things that Disney has ever done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, score is important in an animated film, but to make it like the centerpiece is really cool. And to take so many like different and varied shorts and put them all into one using similar ideas is really cool.
Yeah. And it's the thing I really like about Fantasia, not the thing, a thing I really like about Fantasia, there's a few on the list, is the presentation of it, of being more than just an animated feature.
Right.
And being more than a concert. It was portrayed as a concert plus
an experience.
Yeah, that's what they would call it on the poster and stuff, was the Fantasia experience. And even in the movie opens up with the orchestra walking in, right, and with Deems Taylor coming in and introducing the movie, and he introduces it as, you know, not as the movie you're going to see tonight or as the concert you're going to listen to. He enters as the experience of Fantasia.
Yeah.
So even in the movie, they're calling it an experience and saying that it's more than.
Right.
So. Right. But let's, if you're good, jump into.
Yeah.
The actual movie that we watched.
So yeah, it does start out with the actual orchestra and the conductor coming in. Mm-hmm. And the funniest thing about the sequence to me, and the entire footage of the orchestra to me, is that there are two women in this entire orchestra, and they both play the harp. I just thought that was so random. And the narrator, what was his name? I totally forgot.
Deems Taylor?
Yes. He comes in, and he stands right between the two ladies. What decision? How did they make this decision? Like, two women in the entire orchestra? Stand in between them. I thought that was really funny.
He's got it planned out. He knows what he's doing. So.
But yeah, I really like, it's like kind of odd, but I really like the lighting they did on the orchestra. So like, you can't, it's kind of blue and moody and it's not super well lit.
Yeah.
And I think that's really nice because it doesn't, I think if it was just like, you know, in broad daylight sort of lighting, it would kind of take away from the experience of the music and the narration and the information we get before the pieces.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I agree with that. And so he introduces the idea of Fantasia and what it's going to be. And he introduces, he takes a little bit of a time to set up how it's going to work with the three different pieces, with the right. Storytelling piece, the clear ideas but no story, and then the abstract
right,
idea,
right.
Which is the first one with Toccata and Fugue in D minor.
Yes.
Which is Bach. Piece. Yes. And how it is.
First of all, do excuse any pronunciation we do on this. We are not
classically trained talkers.
But yeah.
I watched some of the commentary on the DVD afterwards so I could hear what they would say, and I'm trying to mimic it. But so it, that begins with Stokowski walking up, and it begins very much how I feel it would be sitting in an orchestra watching them. You're very aware of the conductor and right. the moves he's making, and when an instrument plays, you look at that instrument and you see that instrument, and it's very slow and pacing as to when the animation starts.
Right. And it's very, very abstract. It's not, yeah. It's mostly just forms and, colors and things.
It begins with lights and, you know, the instruments that are playing light up. And as we dissolve into the cloud thing, the first thing we see animated are still musical instruments, the violin bows.
Yeah.
And so it's still musical. We're not completely detached from the musical instrument aspect of it and the being aware of those.
Right.
As we get into the animation part and what is theoretically happening in the mind's eye at that point beyond the confines of the symphony.
Right.
And so.
I can't say that I have a lot to talk about for this piece because it is so abstract. And, I mean, it was really interesting in concept, and I, like, enjoyed watching it. But after a while, I was like, I'm getting kind of tired of Blobs.
Well, it's...
And it was short, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But, you know, like, a minute or so in, I was like, okay, I'm kind of done with
it was, Blobs and it Sparkles. It was kind of an experimental film-looking thing.
Yeah.
And if, you know... It's still, it's there for the music very much, and right. So if you're not really into classical music for the sake of classical music, then it can be kind of a deterrent.
Right, right.
But I really did like the one shot of the rolling hills and the changing color rolling hills.
I like that one too. That was
and
really
that one has stuck with me from liking it as a child.
Yeah.
And being fascinated with that. And so I knew that shot was happening somewhere in there. The shot I didn't remember that was really weird was where like the rock walked away from the screen.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the funniest thing. No, it's just like weird shape and it's moving away from, I don't know why.
It's moving to the these really low tones. There's a boom, boom, boom. And it's some sort of blob that walks away. And it did take me out of the movie. I'm like, excuse me, what is this thing?
Yeah. I just, the funniest thing to me about this sequence was there was like a sequence, a small section with a bunch of like moving polka dots. And I just, yep. I looked at it and I was like, you know, I don't normally think of polka dots when I think of Bach. That's not my immediate connection. Bach, polka dots. I thought that was very funny.
Somebody made that connection. Somebody in 1938 in Walt Disney Studios was hearing that. It's like, I'm seeing some polka dots right now.
But I did really like the clouds, and I liked the sunsets that they had. Those are really pretty.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate why they did that. Like, I can totally understand what they were going for. But I don't have as much to say to it other than polka dots bark. That's funny.
Well, it's an interesting way to open up the movie. And it's a very confident way to open up your movie.
Yeah.
When, you know, when the thing everybody knows from it is Mickey Mouse and Sorcerer's Stone. And a lot of the early promotional material was Mickey Mouse... not Sorcerer's Stone, Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Wrong movie.
So, it's, you know, that's what everybody associates with the movie. And so, but starting it like this is starting it how an experience in a concert would be.
Right.
So, it's not my favorite piece in the movie, but I do like that they started with that. It's a confident move that, to start with that, but... The next one is Nutcracker Suite.
I love this one. there are two or three sequences in this movie that are, like, super, like, I don't want to say girly, because they're not really that girly, but, you know, they have fairies and centaurs and stuff, and those are all my favorites. But this one is beautiful. Pretty much all of my notes on this were just, like, all in caps, like, No, seriously. All in caps. Let's see. I have light up flowers. All of the sparklies. little mushroom shaking his butt.
Yeah.
Like, all of these are in caps. Because I was just... It's really, 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 really pretty. Okay, the thing that struck me about the introduction to this was he says that the Nutcracker isn't performed very often anymore, and I honestly could not tell if he was kidding because he said it really seriously. And I was like, because I can wander down to Raleigh like every year and see it. I've seen it like 7 times, dude. What are you talking about?
I don't know how it was in 1938.
That's true. I don't know if it was as common back then, or like he's just kidding and really bad at telling jokes.
Well, the thing is, all of the pieces in this movie, I know from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though this is from The Nutcracker, and I know this, and I know Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, it's a Fantasia piece in my head.
Okay.
And I know all of these pieces from Fantasia. And I wonder how much of an impact it had on these specific pieces throughout the years, knowing these pieces, and them just being in my head where I recognized and everything. I didn't recognize these pieces watching it as a kid because I didn't know them.
Right.
But watching it now, I can hum along to almost every single one of these pieces because I've heard it so much. And
yeah.
But each and every one of them came from Fantasia first to me.
Yeah.
I never saw Nutcracker before the first time I saw Fantasia.
No. See, I grew up doing ballet, so I had seen the Nutcracker quite a few times. And, you know, I know I can point out to you which dance is which in this song. So, like, I don't know. That's why I had a connection. So it was really weird to me when he was like, you know, it's not as popular anymore. And I'm like, are you sure? Do you know a lot about ballet? It's like,
super popular.
Do you want to do some research on that first before we're making that claim? But yeah, it starts out with fairies.
All it does. Little and they fairies kind of wake up and spread the little fairy dust around the world.
They're putting dew on things. They're putting dew on flowers, and they're going through the spider webs. I love
the spider web one is very pretty.
It was it looked like they were stringing beads on the spider web, and I remember there were some fairies like bathing in a flower, which I thought was really cute.
Yeah, and that's specifically Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. We move away from the fairies when we get to Chinese dance.
Yes,
which is the mushrooms.
The tea.
Which,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mushrooms. Oh my goodness, they're cute, but a little bit offensive. I didn't remember. They've got like little slanty kind of generic Asian eyes, which is a little awkward. And their mushroom caps are definitely perceived as being, you know, like generic Chinese hat things. And I'm like, oh, I didn't remember that being that way.
Yeah.
But it's really cute. It's a cute little sequence. And I love the way they dance. And I love the tiny mushroom that keeps, like, falling over and shaking his butt. And and
I like the little out-of-step kid mushroom who tries so hard.
The most interesting thing about this entire song to me in this animated sequence was how well they did transitions, because they stay basically in the same area of a forest, I would say.
Yeah.
But they go through like very different passages of music and very different characters and context. But they do it in a really, really elegant and nice way. Flowers. The falling flowers are next. The like.
Yes, yeah. Dances of Flutes.
Yes.
And so. And that's the one. Oh, that's a real pretty. That's one that really acknowledges dance in the
thing.
And then the mushrooms do too. And that doesn't happen a lot throughout the movie, is the
idea of dance being used other than the
obviously the
ballet sequence.
Yeah, the Dance of the Hours, which comes later.
Yes.
But
yeah, these little flowers, these aren't even like flower people. Later on in this, they look more like people, but these are just little petals that kind of look like skirts, and they move around in such a way that really, really suggests dance, which I think is really pretty.
Those do, and the leaves fly, like floating down through the air. That was a gorgeous shot. And
it was really, really pretty.
That really, like that specific 5 seconds or anything really was captivating.
Yeah.
Watching those leaves kind of dance around each other.
And
we go underwater next.
Fishies!
To the goldfish.
And
this is the part I was talking about in the last podcast of how Pinocchio reminded me of Fantasia.
Looks like the fish.
And there's this let's explore underwater big old sequence in both these movies where they're just demonstrating an animation of these fish and how fish move and in underwater scenarios.
Right.
And
I thought this was a really interesting part of it because typically in ballet, this is used as kind of a very sensual section. And I just thought it was really delightful how they were like, you know what's sensual? Fish. Let's go with fish. And like the way they use the tails and the fins in like that veil-like texture, and even the bubbles and like the underwater atmosphere, I think is really, really neat to like kind of emphasize that sort of Middle Eastern feel to the song that's typically mm-hmm. done in the ballet.
Yeah.
And I just kept watching that white fish and being like, sexy fish, what's with that? That's kind of funny. But it was really pretty, and the fish did look quite a bit like Cleo, I noticed that. Yeah. And yeah, they do some neat little synchronized swimming sort of moves and stuff, which I think is really cool.
It's still with the dance theme of this piece. The whole this was the nature part. I remember calling it or nature song when I was a kid and didn't know what the Nutcracker suit was. It was the nature chunk.
And then we get to the other flower sequence.
Yeah, the thistles that are Russian.
Yes, the Russian sequence. And I love that they're little like. Yeah, the thistles have little fluffy tops, like hats, and then the other flowers have like they have like pointy bonnet shaped heads, which I think is really cool.
This was my favorite part of this sequence as a kid, and I think it was just because it was like so fast and furious, especially in compared to some of these more slower, beautiful dances, and it was very, very forceful.
Yeah.
And I remember getting a kick out of that in these fast paced. And it ends in this, like, shocking climax as it flashes back into still
the
plants.
Yeah. And then the fairies come back up. And
the fairies come, and they bookend the whole piece nicely in Waltz of the Flowers.
They go through the gilding of the leaves for fall, and I think that's just a gorgeous piece of animation where they, like, touching all the leaves and they turn gold. It's really beautiful. And like there's an interesting textural quality to this sequence. It gets the backgrounds get kind of fuzzy. Like earlier on in the piece, it was like very crisp and you could see the forest sort of idea. But this, it got kind of hazy, which I thought was really interesting and nice. Then they go through the frost. The thing I remembered most when I was a kid about this sequence was the fairies ice skating.
I remember that. And I know the reason I remember that is because I had a sing-along VHS of Christmas, Disney Christmas things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would do generic stuff like Joy to the World and It's Snowing Outside. Let It Snow.
Yeah. It's Snowing Outside. That's a good Christmas song, y'all. That's my favorite.
And because they're doing these generic Christmas songs, they're just taking footage from like the snow episodes of, you know, Donald Duck shorts. And one of the things they did was take this whole Frost Fairies sequence. And so I remember watching that in this ice skating that they do, which is really pretty in the swirls. And so I remember that very vividly.
I also really loved in this sequence, there's fairies falling with the snowflakes and they're wearing the snowflakes like skirts. And I thought that was the cutest little detail because they look like tutus. Mm-hmm. And they're all, like, pancake tutus, which I think is so, so cute. And then it wraps up in the winter.
Yeah.
With all the snow. This one was maybe my favorite. It's between this one or the Greek gods one.
Yeah.
But, oh, my goodness. It was just so pretty. Everything was really, really pretty. Like, unnecessarily pretty. Every five seconds, I was keyboard smashing in my notes. Like, all of the pretty.
It was very nice. And then we get to Sorcerer Apprentice, which is the big, tentpole part of Fantasia. I was surprised, again, that this was 30 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, it's because, like halfway through.
You know, that's the thing, is because I remember those a little bit before Sorcerer's Apprentice, but I remember thinking as a kid, that's where it really gets going.
Yeah.
In the movie, that's where it really starts picking up and actually telling stories. And so, again, it took 30 minutes to get to that point. And I think that, again, reinforces this slow descent into the music that the audience would experience before they're ready to accept music as the sole form of storytelling, or as the dominant form of storytelling.
Right.
For these pieces.
When he was introducing this sequence, he talked about the fact that this is based on an older story. And as he was going through, like, the basic story, I was really struck by how much it reminded me of Struganona. Did you ever read Struganona as a kid?
I did read Struganona as a kid, yes.
Boil, pasta pot.
With the spaghetti. Yeah. That would never stop.
And I was curious if they were based on the same thing. I didn't, like, Google that or anything because I'm lazy. But I just thought, I hadn't thought about it before at all. But, like, I thought that was really interesting that I just suddenly made that connection.
Well, the thing I really thought was cool about it was going back to when this was, like, a rebirth for the Mickey Mouse character to bring him up. And there was a big redesign of Mickey Mouse at this time. Chiefly, the thing that's most noticeable is his eyes got pupils instead of being those black dots. And there were actually, due to just timing, there were a couple of shorts released with the new Mickey Mouse design before Fantasia came out. But Fantasia was what the redesign was for. And we've recently listened to a bunch of stories about a Mickey Mouse revamp with the Epic Mickey video game.
Right, right.
And they were talking about how, you know, Mickey is too much of a goody two-shoes character and all these problems that they were talking about back then. And so they've gone back to this mischievous scamp Mickey and this less than perfect character. And that struck me watching Sorcerer's Apprentice was, you know, it was this Mickey who was, you know, eager to do stuff and kind of getting too big for his own shoes and getting himself into some serious trouble that he can't get himself out of.
Right, right.
And so,
this opens up with Yensid, who's the wizard who you mentioned last time freaked you out as a child. And I can
was scary.
I can totally see why. He's a very intimidating character.
And part of it is that he doesn't talk, and he obviously doesn't talk for, you know, nobody talks in this movie. but he's angry all the time because we only see him, you
twice.
Know. Yeah.
We see him in the beginning when he's like, Mickey, don't touch my stuff. So he's like really stern. And then we see him at the end where he's like, Mickey, you touched my stuff. So he's angry. And then Mickey comes in and he's got the weirdest outfit on. Like, I really love Sorcerer Hat Mickey. Like, I think that outfit is really cute. But, like, I never noticed before, and I don't know if they've changed this for the character in the park. Mm-hmm. But he's got on this robe that for some reason doesn't have a front. It's like a shirt in the front, and then it's got a back to it. And then he's wearing shorts. And I'm like, is this what you choose to work in, Mickey? This is a little weird. Then they see we see Yensid doing some magic. He's turning. He's like making a bat, and then he turns it into a butterfly.
And it's a very much of a just because he can kind of feel.
Yeah.
Which,
he looks like he looked like he was, like, practicing. He's like, I gotta get this butterfly, bat butterfly spell right. This will be super useful in life.
He had nothing better to do. He'd conquered all the magic of the world. Like, he was he was this premier wizard, or sorcerer, I guess.
Yeah. So. And he wanders off. We don't know where he goes.
He goes to take a nap.
Nap time. So he takes off his magic hat and leaves it just, like, chilling there. And I'm like, is that the wisest idea? Probably not.
And Mickey wastes no time.
Yep, and he pops on the hat. Which, like, I'm kind of surprised that it fits both Yensid and Mickey's head, to be honest, because Yensid has a normal dude-sized head, and Mickey has kind of a large, roundy,
Mickey Mouse-sized
head.
Well, magic of animation. We can just erase a little bit.
I love this song, and this I automatically associate this song with the shirt.
This is my favorite musically of all the pieces.
It's got such a good rhythm to it that it works so well for the broom movement. So Mickey transforms the broom, which is a creepy sequence, I suddenly realized. He, like, the arms, like, pop out.
The arms kind of pop out. And I hear a lot that it was a mop, and so I don't know where that came from, and I guess it's because mops are associated with water a lot.
He's not actually mopping.
It's very clearly a broom.
And which was, yeah, just sitting around. He's not actually doing anything with the water. He's carrying the water back to the thing. I don't really understand what he was trying
filling,
to do.
He's filling a cauldron of some kind.
I thought it was it looked like a well almost.
Yeah, but I'm assuming it's some sort of hole that's a contained amount of water, and he's filling it from some spring water outside.
I guess so.
But now that he has the hat, he can't be bothered with it, and he sends the broom to do his menial task. And the broom is super effective.
It is. It is so really effective.
We get this really nice sequence of Mickey dreaming, and he dreams he's basically master of the universe. And
basically.
Controlling all these forces of nature.
Yeah, I like how he just like aimlessly falls asleep. This is so funny to me. Like, I just did all of this magic. I just did a little dance around the broom. Seems like nap time to me.
Maybe there's a spell in this sorcerer castle where everybody's gotta take a nap after doing a magic trick.
Yep. The dream sequence, he's like super all powerful and he conjures up this like giant storm.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wakes up and he's like, oh, the entire room is full of water.
And yeah, in that nap sequence, the broom has more than efficiently done all that's necessary for the job.
Seriously, that broom is a responsible broom, and Mickey does not treat it properly. Because
you mean hitting it with an axe?
Yeah, just after he wakes up, he's like, the only way to solve this problem is to kill the broom. And like, my immediate response is that broom like cognitive? Is he killing a broom? He like hacks it up too, like full on, like creepy horror movie murder style.
Oh man, no! My first response was like a terrible, you know, Dungeons and Dragons player who like that's their sole answer to everything is I hit it with my axe.
Very good, Mickey. You make an excellent elf.
Whoever has axes in that game. But that doesn't do any good because something in the magic, and that's such like an interesting thing as to why all of these splinters now have enough magical powers to create fully fledged form brooms of their own, as well as buckets, which were in no way part of the broom.
They're just like very conjured out of magic broom dust.
Yep.
Which is so weird. And then, yeah, the brooms are they basically overpower all of this water. There's enough water in the room that Mickey climbs on a book and uses it as a boat. And I'm like, that is the largest book, Mickey. Where did that come from?
Well, it's a magic book. It's
magic book have to ancient, be of regulation, spells and stuff. Giant magic size.
You gotta fit, like, a whole spell on each page for efficiency. So.
And then Yenzi comes back in, and he's really grumpy, and he pulls a Moses. That's what he does. He's like, bought the waters.
And so if he can do all that without his hat, which is Mickey's getting all his power from, Yenzi's one powerful dude.
Seriously.
And so clears away all the water, and then does this glare, and this eyebrow raise, and everybody who has done interviews about this movie has said, like, we were sure that was the dead giveaway, that this is totally Walt Disney, a caricature of Walt Disney, was this one eyebrow raise at the end of the movie, or at the end of the sequence. And so.
And then he's only angry enough to, like, swat him in the butt with a broom.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, I thought he was gonna, like, lock him up somewhere, or, you know, chop him to death with an axe, like everybody else seems to do around here. And then at the end, the conductor talks to Mickey, which I thought
he does. Oh, that's a really interesting little thing.
It's so cute.
Where Stokowski gives him a little shake of the hand, and you're like, "Oh, that's nice."
He was so cute. I really like that.
And it goes back to Taylor again narrating, and there's a really interesting little thing where when he starts to narrate, there's a crash in the orchestra, and we cut away, and somebody has fallen into their bells.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that was funny.
That was, like, the weirdest thing, because I'm like, they have editing power. What happened there that they're like, no, we gotta keep this in here? And apparently,
it bothered me enough to like go and research it. Apparently, they were really worried that having lots of classical music and people in tuxedos would feel really snooty to a common audience.
So they wanted to be a little silly.
Intentionally put this, yeah, this basic gag in here so that they could be like, no, funny. we're rib elbowing funny too. So,
okay. So we get to the Rite of Spring.
We get to the Rite of Spring, which is,
Stravinsky.
Yes. And it was, yes. He was the only living composer at the time.
Oh, that's interesting.
When this movie came out. So he actually personally gave the permission to make this movie. And it's basically, it's the beginning of time and the origin of all time.
Yep.
And I remember it as the dinosaur one.
Yeah, I do too.
But it does. It has so much stuff before the dinosaurs.
Microbes and stuff.
It starts with nothing, and slowly, like the galaxy and universe comes into creation. I'm like,
I think the funniest thing about this is the first thing I wondered was like, do creationists allow their children to watch Fantasia? Because this definitely supports evolutionary theory.
Well, the thing is, at the beginning, when Taylor was introducing the piece, he goes on and on about what the piece is about.
He does.
And
I'm like,
he basically explains the whole piece. And, you know, I'm thinking about, why is he doing this? This is so unnecessary. I'm going to watch this piece in a few minutes anyway. And I thought about it, and I was like, if this movie came out in 1940, you know, I wonder what the general knowledge of dinosaurs was back then.
That's true.
And it's kind of conceivable that there are people watching this movie who were alive when dinosaurs were discovered. these are dinosaurs. That's and stuff.
Funny. And, my favorite thing about the narration before this is he calls Tyrannosaurus Rexes the bullies and gangsters of the dinosaurs. And I was like, man, that's dated.
Yeah, he does. So, we go and we start with little microbes, and we watch evolution, and up to the point of the dinosaurs. And
It starts out first with our galaxy. It starts out with the galaxy,
and the cluster of clouds goes by, and the sun goes by, or the giant flaming star goes by.
And then we get to the surface.
Yeah.
And there's like basically nothing but lots of lava and mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And like more lava and volcanoes and like bubbly things.
Yep. There's just this really kind of dark piece.
This piece kind of freaks me out.
It's
even compared to Bald Mountain. Which we'll get to later. Me out more.
Well, the thing is, it's like almost upsettingly realistic. Like it's an animated movie, but it's nothing about it is cartoony. These are not the cartoony dinosaurs.
This is not Land Before Time.
We'll go ahead and skip to the thing that everybody knows is the Tyrannosaurus. Going after the Stegosaurus.
Right? Yeah.
And killing a Stegosaurus. And that's the first time, in Disney that something kills something else. Unless you count, like, the tiny little microbe that kills the other tiny little microbe 3 minutes earlier in the same piece.
Just munches on a little bit.
You know, this is the first, battle to the death and killing of a living being.
That's so disturbing. Yeah.
And it's really sombering.
The music itself is very unnerving. It's got a lot of like discord to it.
Intensity.
That's very unsettling.
Yeah. It's not a happy feely piece.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination.
In fact, right in the middle of this, I wrote, can we go back to the happy snowflake fairies now? It's like, no, I'm done with this.
We go through it, and the Tyrannosaurus, the bad guy, wins, and that I remember really shocking me as a kid was
no, a Stegosaurus?
Because even playing with my toys as a kid, you know, the Triceratops got away, or and he still had those horns or the spiked tail, and so that's how they defended themselves and beat the T-Rex, because the T-Rex was the bad guy in my little toy collection.
Of course.
Because he was the bullies and the gangsters of,
of the
ancient world, yeah. But, you know, there's no repercussions for this character. It's a very animalistic thing to have happen. And then we go on, and the end result is the rest of them die, too.
Oh, by the way.
every character in this piece dies.
Awesome.
And we watch them die. It's not, you know, Peachy Dubs, they die. We watch this, like, really slow death of painful, these characters.
Yeah.
You know, and of starvation and heat. And, you know, not like, oh, they've died. It's this slow extinction, and we get that slow zoom in on that skull, and then it even like starts breaking up, and the skeletons are destroyed, and like it was just really like, oh, and it's a strong piece, and I really liked it as a kid because dinosaurs,
obviously. We start out with all the lava and junk, and then we get to water. And bacteria. And actually, this is the, other than the Tyrannosaurus, Stegosaurus fight, this is what I remember most about this, because every time I take a biology class, and we're talking about bacteria for a while, that's all I think of, is the little microbes in this sequence. And then, you know, we segue into smaller, or less, you know, larger water things, and then we segue into dinosaurs. They're not like happy cartoony dinosaurs. Like,
no, it's
they're I think fairly accurate, at least to their knowledge at the time, and they're pretty scary looking. The pterodactyls freaked me out. Their eyes are really creepy.
Oh yeah, that one pterodactyl comes down and like scoops something out of the water to eat, and then something else scoops out and like pulls him down by his head.
So
I'm like, oh man, this is really intense.
Yeah, here's my second get me out of here reference. Gee, I sure miss Land Before Time right about now. even the I guess they're not brontosauruses anymore, right? Something happened with brontosauruses.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they are in that movie.
Yeah, definitely. The brontosauruses even are like not just like happy chewing on plants things. They're like fighting each other for food, and I'm like, dude. It's like right there. Why you gotta fight him for it? This isn't happy.
That's how it happens, and that's how it ends. And that was there's no positive story arc there. It's just it's just very
the struggle for survival.
Yeah,
the end.
Realistic and kind
and
of intense.
We see a
this
bunch
is
of...
how the world works, kids. Welcome to upsetting.
They go through a pretty large selection of dinosaurs. There's egg stealing in a sequence. There's some sort of nesting dinosaur, and this little dinosaur comes in and like tries to steal an egg, and the dinosaur's like, no, this is my egg. And then it goes, that's exactly what it says actually.
Yep, no, this is my egg.
Only dialogue in Fantasia ever. No, this is my egg.
Not one talking dinosaur.
The little dinosaur goes to another nest, and the like mother's not paying attention, and it like steals an egg, and I'm like, eating her child. Oh god. You do get baby dinosaurs just afterwards. So that's a little bit more cheerful. But you know, those baby dinosaurs probably.
You know what happens to those baby dinosaurs?
They die.
Starvation and heat. I don't remember that affecting me at all.
Oh my god.
As a kid, but like
that's
watching it through
this
time, I was like, oh man, that's really, and because it's not, it's such an extended part of it too.
Yeah. So then the T-Rex comes in and he comes like barreling through the trees sort of thing. And I do really remember the sequence as a child.
The chase and this poor Stegosaurus.
I just remembered that one of my notes in this sequence is, just think, in 40 years, they made, I have a big head and arms.
Yeah, that's the T-Rex evolution of Disney.
Oh, that's so funny. I totally forgot I wrote that. And then My favorite part of the sequence actually is not necessarily the fight, although the fight is really amazing. It's the dinosaurs standing around in the background, being like, oh, man, I'm glad that's not me. Sort of like,
that's the kind of thing. I guess they don't have to run anymore. The Tyrannosaurus has a whole Stegosaurus to eat now.
Occupied.
So.
And the Stegosaurus dies.
Yep. Then he also killed him by biting his neck, by the way. He didn't, like, push him over a cliff, you know?
And, like, you see his eyes slide close as he dies.
Yeah.
And he's like, the T-Rex is already munching on him at that point. And I'm like, oh, God, how did this not traumatize me as a child?
Yep.
It scares
me. I can't get over it. It was the most shocking part of rewatching Fantasia.
I agree with the sequence.
This sequence, it's been such a long time since I've watched this sequence. You know, throughout the years, I watched Fantasia a lot of bit by bit. Like, oh, I really like Sorcerer's Apprentice. Let me watch that segment again. Or I really liked, Night on Bald Mountain. Let me just watch that little piece again because I like that. And so Rite of Spring kind of slipped through. And so watching it the whole way is just, oh, man.
And then it segues to that part with all the dinosaurs dying.
Dinosaurs dying slowly.
They're on pulling. This mud plane, and they're trying to get water out of the mud, and mm-hmm. they're biting at each other, and everybody's fighting for water, and then all the dinosaurs die.
All the dinosaurs die, and earthquakes crush their skulls.
Yeah, yeah. So. There was crazy earthquake stuff.
And it kind of just zooms out and ends there. Yeah. There's no hope for a better day.
Nope.
And apparently there was talk of eventually having more scenes with people creating, the first man, learning stuff. Man-less and that's stuff. That got cut because of, potential controversy. So that was where they're like, nope, this is what's gonna upset that's people. Funny. So
that's Rite of Spring. For such a pleasant sounding title. Rite of Spring, no.
Mm-mm.
No, the Rite of Spring to die slowly of starvation, thanks. No.
It's, and then we go back to Mr. Taylor, who takes an intermission, which is really cool.
I know, that's so delightful. I was so excited to see an intermission.
He takes an intermission, and that's when the title card pops up.
Yes.
Depending on what version you watch, but that's when it happened in theaters, and that's the first time you see Fantasia, the word written on the screen. And what was so cool about it, about the beginning and ending of the intermission, was you watched the
orchestra
stand up and walk away and then walk back in, which if it really, for me, reinforced the not a movie, an experience motif. Because in a movie, you would never see that. You would never have 3 minutes of people standing up and walking away,
or coming which back in no way and, served. Coming back and tuning instruments, warming up.
Yeah, which would happen as a chorus,
right?
Or a orchestra.
Orchestra, and then we get the pastoral from Beethoven.
We meet the soundtrack first.
That's which is, right. I forgot about that. Sorry, I didn't take notes on that. I think my only notes were yay.
it's a short little piece. It's a cool little piece where they kind of just animate. Sound in, mm-hmm. in this one line which moves and the reason I really liked it and its placement is again reinforcing they don't jump straight back into here's another full story based on music it doesn't take as long as it does in the first time but if you've walked away for the 15 minute intermission which theoretically would have happened then
and,
it takes a few minutes to get back into the feel of Fantasia.
Right.
And so.
And they do, it's the soundtrack, and he, does different instruments. It's animated as, sound waves.
Yeah.
That was really cool. And I loved how different all of the sound waves looked, and my favorite was, I think, the bassoon. That was, super low. He was like, don't be shy. You can go as low as you like. It's just brrr.
Yeah. So cute. My favorite was a fart.
He did fart. I do recall that. That was really funny.
But then we get to the Pastoral Symphony. which is Beethoven's Six.
I was so glad this was after the dinosaurs, because I was like, I really need something happy right now. I need a hug.
I love, love, love the Pastoral Symphony.
I think this is so cute. I love the characterization that they do in this piece, and I love the beautiful landscapes, and I love all the silly different kinds of, animals and magical creatures sort of thing.
This one gets introduced much in the same way as Rite of Spring did, where Taylor stands up and says the whole piece beat for beat, and I'm sitting there going, why are we gotta do this? And I don't have a dinosaur explanation like I did before, unless people just didn't know their Greek myths back then.
Yeah, I think it was just mostly to emphasize the idea behind it and who everyone was. Because, like, I probably would have recognized most of them, but I didn't remember, like, the rainbow goddess or whatever.
Yeah. Well,
I think it was a nice little story.
He mixed up Roman and Greek names willy-nilly.
Yeah, he did. Because
he said
that.
Bacchus. And the thing is, instead of Festus, he said Vulcan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Vulcans didn't exist. Like, Star Trek Vulcans didn't exist when this movie came out. Because otherwise, you wouldn't dare do that. Because you would just confuse everybody.
It's true.
And so, because that's the first thing I was like, Vulcans are not in this? And I was like, oh, wait a minute, Vulcans of Festus. I remember this from school. But you said this was Greek mythology, so it's your fault, Deems Taylor, and not mine for the confusion.
My favorite part of his intro to this is that he calls them centaurettes. As though we need a different girl word
They're for girlfriends, people who the are also
And I'm like, are you kidding me? Is that really necessary? I'd never heard that term before in my life.
Nope, and I haven't since. But
for
here now, they're the centaurettes. And so we open up on, I think, the little pan characters were first. The satyrs.
No, I think it starts out with the
Does it start out with unicorns? The unicorns?
Yeah. Yes. It starts out with both of them, but they're like, frolicking in fields.
And these characters are, like, the epitome of how to draw cute characters. They have faces and the giant eyes.
Oh, my
God. They are the scientific way to invoke cuteness in a cartoon character.
I just want plushies of all of them. Why don't they make Fantasia plushies? Oh, my God. They're all these cute little magical creatures with big eyes and round
I have not done the research, but I am willing to bet that there is a direct inspiration for My Little Pony from these unicorns and Pegasus characters from this sequence. We move on to the Pegasus and his entire family, as Taylor described in the intro. And by the way, Pegasus himself looks like a Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse kind of horse.
Oh my God, because he's all black and scary.
Yeah, and he's got the red eyes. I mean, he's like, I'm going to take my family on an outing today.
It would be like if you saw, like, a giant wrestler bodybuilder dude, like, going on a picnic with his family. Like, someone you're not used to seeing in that sort of context.
I thought it was really interesting, but I really like my Pegasus.
He's a good daddy, though, so that's nice.
Yep. That's how I like my Pegasus, I think, is with his, his little son who can't fly yet and kind of figures it out for a while.
Oh, it's so cute.
It's very sweet.
His little wings are too small, and his mom, like, pulls him up by the tail and pushes him along. It's so cute.
And then he pulls himself up by the tail, defying all laws of physics, okay, because it's the current. And this is, like, at that point, I'm like, this is the exact opposite of everything about Rite of Spring.
It's true.
Because this is how cartoons act in cartoons.
Right.
With their little sweetness and.
And then they all go flying together. They're
flying. Mm-hmm.
And they meet up with a bunch of other Pegasi. Is that the word? Pegasi, I guess.
Sure.
Pegasus.
Other winged horses.
Other winged horses. And they all, like, the kids, it looks like a family reunion. The kids all run off and do cannonballs and stuff.
And they just have fun.
Yes, they look
lots of fun. And then we move on to the centaurs and centaurettes.
No, first get just ingeniously beautiful waterfalls. We go through some waterfalls first, and they are beautiful.
Yep.
Okay. Now we can move on to the centaurs.
The centaurs and the centaurettes.
The centaurettes. They are so pretty. I just love that they're like, the girl, it starts with the girl centaurs. I'm not calling centaurs.
It starts with them bathing, and they're just girls bathing, and so they start walking out of the water, and you're like, there's some horse.
That's a horse there. There's cherubs. The cherubs are helping them get ready. And I'm like, where's my cherubs to help me get I want a cherub in the morning to, like, blow dry my hair. I love the little cherubs. They're so, so cute. They've got little translucent wings and little, like, cupie curl hair. And,
There's a few times watching this, I'm like, why are those just babies flying? I'm like, oh, there's the wings. Oh, I don't quite see them.
Got the cutest little butts. Oh, they're so cute. And then, you know, the ladies have gotten all ready. And
they're just lolling about when the dudes come up, and they're like, and so then they go get them super ready because
I'm bathed, but I gotta go put on hats.
And they all make Lady Gaga style hats, which none of these hats are actual hats.
Well, in the 40s, actually, really structural, interesting hats were not actually that uncommon, but they do see some strange things. There was a really cute one where they just put like a lily pad like straight on her head.
Yep.
But my favorite, I know you know what I'm gonna say, was my favorite was the giant cone.
The cone hat.
First of all, they're destroying live plants for this, mind you. He goes and like rips off the bark off of a birch tree, and I'm like, that's awful, that poor birch tree. But then the cherub makes it into this like cone thing. He wraps some vines around it or something, and this centaur girl's like, yes, that's perfectly appropriate for this occasion.
No, the most ridiculous one is where the two doves are her hat. And the cherub's like, nope, two doves have to be different, and the doves have to be different, and then he's like, this isn't quite crazy enough. You dove, spread your wing at all points.
Yes, it's so, so funny.
And then they start meeting up and segregating by color.
Pretty much. They kind of dance at each other, which I thought was really cute. Like, centaur mating dance. Mm. We are now observing in the wild the dance of the centaurs.
The thing is, there's these very, you know, they are separated by color, and like blue and green, and you know, these just these crazy Crayola 8 colors.
The blue one with the really long tail is my favorite. Did you have a favorite? I didn't have a favorite.
The most memorable one though was the orange one, because my first thought was like, why is there a Jersey Shore centaur in my centaur world?
Yes, Joel.
And then I'm like, oh man, 1940s, like, could not have predicted, like, all these years later, like, orange is gonna be an actual person color.
There's a blue girl centaur, and she's got, like, this giant long tail that, like, drags in the ground and is full of flowers, and that one's really pretty.
And the curtains close, and they all fly away to Goom's privacy, except the one little guy who sticks it out, and his butt turns into a heart. And you're like, oh my goodness, you just animated cuteness personified, Disney.
Oh god, it was so cute. And then we get to Bacchus.
We do.
God of wine. And god he of is wine. Like super
well, I'm going to call really Dionysus funny. By accident. I'm going to go ahead and say it.
It's cool.
Because.
And.
We're having a wonderful party. Like, all the characters
creatures.
From previous. Sequences all come back. At which point I noticed there's no humans in this sequence.
Other than the gods, I guess, if you can count them.
Yeah, if you count
human
gods.
Looking, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, there are no humans. There's
satyrs,
fauns. Yeah, there's satyrs. There's
centaurs.
Centaurs. There's unicorns. There's pegasi. There's no like standard animals either. Mm. It's all magical creatures. Yeah.
There's a donkey unicorn.
I love the donkey unicorn. Bacchus comes in riding on this like tiny, tiny donkey unicorn, and it is the cutest thing ever. It looks it's so like drunk and delightful.
Yeah.
And the Satyrs are crushing grapes for wine.
Yes. And everybody is just having the best time.
Oh, and there's some mildly offensive African zebra ladies.
Yeah.
I remember that. There's like centaurs who are black and zebra striped.
Yeah, but they're only in there for a second. They're not quite sunflower bad.
It's just a little awkward. It starts to rain. They're having this awesome party, and everybody's carrying grapes in, and they're getting all crushed, and they're making wine, they're drinking wine, and it starts to rain. And
the thing is, everybody runs out because they know in ancient Greece what rain means. Because it means crazy Zeus is
Zeus is at just it again. Delighted at like striking people with lightning bolts.
I really like the intro to Zeus because, you know, he has this like silhouette shadow and then leans forward.
He's like, hey,
in the clouds and it's like boom and reveals his face and it's crazy Zeus. And that's how I differentiate, because there's two Zeuses in Disney canon,
yes.
Basically.
Yes, basically.
And so there's Happy Zeus in 97 Hercules, and then there's Crazy Zeus from Fantasia.
Although, who's to be all blue. Honest, if Zeus got drunk enough, Hercules Zeus could probably be Crazy Zeus.
Yep.
They do look similar, which I think is cool.
So, yeah. So, I like that. But we have Crazy Zeus, or Smurf Zeus, if you want to call him that, because he's,
he's blue.
Completely and totally blue.
Well, I better hope that Hera is blue, because otherwise, like, we've got problems.
No, but see, by 97, we were progressive, so she could be pink.
Oh, okay. As long as it sticks with gender norms, it's cool.
Yep.
But yeah, Hephaestus is there, you know.
Vulcan, yeah.
And he is real butch. That's the first
Can
thing
I
noticed.
Say I love the character design of that guy, wearing his tiny little loincloth. And just having the happiest smile on his face.
He's so excited.
I'm like, that man loves his job.
Hephaestus, the weird thing to me was Hephaestus is supposed to be, like, super disfigured because he's supposed to be really good at his job, which is why Zeus kept him around, because he didn't like not pretty people. And, Aphrodite had to marry him, and Aphrodite was, like, freaked out about this. She was like, dude, I am not marrying that guy. He is not attractive, sort of thing. She's really shallow. And, but he's supposed to be, like, really ugly. And, like, he has kind of a goofy face, but he's, like, super ripped. His entire, his shoulder span is probably at least, like, 5 or 6 times the size of his hips. He's, like, huge.
I mean, but if you go, like, back in previous, like, before this, if you look at, like, representations of Bacchus, like, he's a cut dude in, like,
that's
Marvel
true.
Sculpture, and Disney's like, he's a circle. And so, the thing is, that's how everybody views that character now.
Yeah.
Like, when you see anything about the gods, there's
Dionysus. It's kind of hard to picture a dude who, like, drinks wine all day as super cut, to be honest.
Yeah.
Not exactly
They weren't 100 sticking to the myths over here.
Yeah.
But so, Zeus, basically, he spends a few minutes just attacking Bacchus and his little donkey unicorn.
I just find that very hard to believe, because of all people, Zeus would not try to kill, essentially, the god of parties. Like, you're not killing the party god, then who'll come to your party?
He's not, you know, killing him because he's a god, but he's just having some fun. And there's, you know, loud explosions in the music, so you gotta do something.
Yeah, that's true.
And so,
I would also like to note that all of these magical creatures are extremely bad at hiding from rain. Like, some of them manage to make it to trees, which is, like, kind of a good idea, but then there's, like, lightning, and you're like, that's not the best plan. But some of them are just, like, I remember in particular one centaur girl, like, freaks out when it starts raining, and she's like, you know, it will help this little thin shawl that I have. And I'm like, lady, what are you doing?
Yeah, but the unicorns hide under other unicorns.
That's true. Oh, that's so funny. They're really not great at rain, apparently. They don't have this phenomenon.
It kind of concludes with Zeus getting bored and getting tired.
He's like, oh, it's like, nap time.
No, thank you on this
list. Everybody loves to take naps in Fantasia. It's true. This
what
is
you
the
do.
Third character to take a nap. No. The fairies were napping.
Yep.
So that's at least four.
Well, that's kind of understandable when you're, like, telling musical stories.
Mm-hmm.
Music starts slow and picks up and then gets slow. Like, yeah, there's that kind of sequence. And so, although Mickey fell asleep right in the middle of Sorcerer's Stone, so I don't have an excuse there. But
yeah,
this build-up and, you know, slowing down of music is present in everything, all these musical compositions. So
right,
it's understandable that the imagination of the animators would go to falling asleep and getting tired.
Right.
So Zeus, he rolls over. He's got, like, one lightning bolt left that Hephaestus gets to throw.
Yep.
And so we get that one extra little cymbal crash, and he gets the one that pokes him. And then he takes off his shoes, and they just fall to Earth. Yeah. And that's my favorite unsolved mystery of the whole movie, is these giant flippy floppies just hanging out.
And he, like, turns over and goes to sleep on the clouds. And then it's rainbow time. Rainbows. Yep. This is friggin' cute. There's rainbow and there's cute animals and they're frolicking the puddles that are rainbowy, and it's just adorable. Everything in here is adorable. And then Apollo comes across the sky and sets the sky. Sun.
Everybody waves at him.
Yep. Okay, Apollo. Exactly. How you doing?
And I remember sitting there, I remember being a kid, being like, there are faces on everything right now. Because I didn't know the names of these things. I just knew that everything was a person all of a sudden. Like, why is the sun a person? I don't understand that one. Why is night a person? Night's not a thing.
Night comes in. Diana shoots from with the crescent moon and scatters a bunch of stars, which I thought was really pretty. And it was
it was just really sweet
pretty
ending.
And then they all fall asleep. I really like this one. It was really pretty, I like the story arc. I thought it was really nice.
Also, this is another one I really like the music in.
Me too.
Because it's Beethoven, like, you kind of have to.
Mandatory for life.
It's the rule.
But yeah, it was really pretty. And that one is good. I like that one.
Yeah. And then we move to Dance of Hours.
Yes.
Which is the ballet one. It's the animals doing ballet. Which, you know, is the thing that is clearly going to pop into your head.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing. Okay, there's a couple funny things about this that I did not remember as a child. I didn't remember that there was any sort of story. When the narrator comes up, he's like, okay, so here's the story of the Dance of the Hours. And it's basically,
I was real thankful for that.
I know, right? Because it's basically, there's four groups of dancers. One to represent the dawn, one to represent the day, one to represent the evening, and one to represent nighttime. And so they're grouped like that. But, you know, when they're silly animals, it's a little hard to remember them as a child. You just remember ostrich ballerina, ostrich ballerina.
I also didn't exactly listen to the narrator when I was a kid.
No, probably.
I was like, that's not animated. This is not for me.
The other thing that struck me as really funny and that I didn't realize as a kid, or like I didn't remember from childhood, was I know this song. Everybody knows this song. I know the song really well.
Because it's Hello Mother, Hello Father.
Hello Father, which I thought was really funny.
No. Watching it this time, as I was doing, I'm going to remember that. Hello, Mada.
Hello, Fada. Yeah, and, like, totally takes away from the seriousness of the piece, because you know it's so serious.
Because it's a super serious piece?
Super serious. So, yeah, he explains it beforehand, which I really like. And I love that this is, like, actual ballet time with animals.
Well, this is the only one that is, other than a little bit with the fairies, but this is clearly ballet, and that's a move, like, that people do.
Yeah, or try to anyway.
Well, the thing is, and it's still at the same time, it's very much a cartoon.
Yeah, this one's very silly, which I like.
Over the top exaggerations. There's been, you know, discussion amongst animation historians and people who were working on time saying it was a parody of prestigious and dance and
I can definitely see that.
It's another poke at the snootiness of, you know, uppity dance people.
So we started with the ostriches. With the ostrich. Which I love. Because they do really look like ballerinas. Their legs are really long and skinny. And they do that lovely ballet dancers are trained to bend their legs in at the knee, and they have mm-hmm. that in the sequence, which I thought was just the cutest little detail. Like, they must have done some pretty intensive research into ballet, yeah. because some of the stuff they do I recognize definitely from dancing as a child. There's not a lot to talk about, to be honest, in these small sequences in the beginning, yeah. because it's mostly just dancing. I mean, there's some cute little moments with, like, falling and splits and stuff.
The individual dances are just dances.
In the first couple, there is a definite lead, which I thought was interesting. In the first one, there's an ostrich, I think, with blue shoes.
The pink one.
Or is it pink one?
No, she's pink and everybody else is blue. Shoes.
And she kind of leads everything, and she wakes mm-hmm. them up. I'm assuming it's a she. I don't know. They all have really, like, long eyelashes and, like, eyeshadow on. Yeah. That was funny. And then they do a little sequence of dance, and then the hippos come in. Oh, no, they eat first.
Everybody's trying.
She goes to the lead dancer, goes to get a cornucopia, and, like, yeah. you know, some of the ashes just take some fruit out of it or whatever, and she's like, oh good, they left me the grapes. And she tries to eat these grapes, and all the other ashes is like, oh, grapes are just like,
they did not intentionally leave her those grapes.
No, they keep stealing the grapes, and she has to, like, run off. And then the hippos come in, and they kind of run the ashes off.
It was, and then, like, the hippos, if there's a main character of this piece, it's the hippos.
The specific hippo, in fact.
The hippo, because they all dance around this clearly lead hippo. Yes. And she has a different color tutu.
Hers is
yellow.
Yellow, and yeah, the others are pink.
Everyone else has pink.
She is sleeping in the beginning, and they go and wake her up. They're mm-hmm. like, hey, hippo lady, come and wake up. I love the lead hippo. Just oozes self-confidence, and I think she's so, so cute. As a kid, I had an actually unrelated to Fantasia, although obviously inspired by it, a Christmas ornament. It was one of my favorite Christmas ornaments, and it was a little hippo in a tutu. And I love the hippo. I don't know why. She seems so happy with herself, and she's so pleased to be dancing, and it's just so cute to watch. And they get her dressed. They put...
Yep. She has her shoes. Yeah.
I would know. You know, who takes naps in point shoes? But okay. Hippos. More napping. Everybody naps.
In well, she doesn't. She doesn't start napping, does she? Doesn't she start coming out in her Venus pose out of the fountain?
Yes, she does. Because
she falls asleep, and the elephants start messing with her.
Yes.
Because elephants are evening.
I did not remember that there were elephants in this. Mm-hmm. I remembered the ostriches. I remembered the hippos. And I remembered the crocodiles. I assume they blended together with the hippos because they're both kind of relatively sized the same.
When he was talking about it at the beginning and he says, there's these four things, I was like, ostrich, mm-hmm. hippo, crocodile,
antelope? Was antelope and in there?
I got to elephant, but it was like a really educated guess.
Yeah.
And I confirmed it later. And the elephants are kind of... Because the hippo stays, mm-hmm. or the main hippo
they're
does.
Not, there's not as much focal point.
And there's this big interaction later between the hippo and the crocodiles.
Mm-hmm.
The elephants are a little bit lost in the shuffle, but I really like the bubbles.
I do too. So. They make little bubble tutus, I think is the cutest part.
Yeah. But then they float away on their bubbles.
Yeah, that was weird. But first, the hippo's chair. She falls asleep on, like, a chaise lounge thing, mm-hmm. and it gets floated up in the air by bubbles. And yep. in my notes, I put, hippo, get down from there! That is no place for a hippo! and yeah, the elephants just kind of blow away on the bubbles, yep. which is
because this one is still very much a cartoon, and right. even more so than the pastoral.
Yeah, I think they're trying to prepare us for Bald Mountain. Like, okay, guys, you gotta get just silly out of the way.
Because there's so much over the top animation. Because then the crocodiles come out, and they are just crazy over the top, you know, bandit characters.
I would like to state that in the intro, the narrator specifically mentions that Knight, all clothed in black, comes in, and I was like, these crocodiles are wearing red, Mr. Narrator. This is an inaccurate portrayal of this animated short. But yeah, so. I love that there's a big group of crocodiles, and then it's just the noble crocodile who comes in.
Who has the purple feather.
He's got the hat and the little feather, and he's like, oh, look at this lovely hippo, which is just so funny, because the rest of them are like, this hippo looks like lunch, and he's like, no, this hippo looks like the rest of my life, sort of thing. It's really funny. And, you know, they dance a pas de deux, which I think is really funny. They dance together, and you know, he's, like, tiny and skinny, and she's a hippo.
And that's the most, like, specific. This is a parody of ballet. Yes. Where we're going to have this scrawny little dude this giant hippo girl version, and they're going to dance together.
Yep.
And especially, like, the lift that does not work.
She, like, runs from afar and jumps and just smooshes him flat.
and the rest of this piece... involves everybody coming back in, and it's such a cartoon.
It is. It's very silly.
And it struck me of how much of a cartoon it is, and partially because up until this point, you know, even with the other Disney movies we've watched, there are exaggerated movements, but everything's fairly based in the reality that it sets early on in the movie.
Yeah.
Of a certain degree of realism. Yeah. And then, you know, and we've just seen Rite of Spring, which is, you know, might as well have been a documentary. So there's so much over-the-top cartoon, you know, people knocking over buildings and, you know, being able to withstand these massive falls from great heights and being crushed by hippos for the sake of cartoon comedy.
I think that one of the most interesting things about this is that the animals are, I clearly perceive as one gender or another, and that was the weirdest thing to me, because, like, the ostriches were all female, the hippos were all female, the elephants were all female, and, like, there was no real clear indication, especially of the elephants, there was no clear indication that they were female. Like, they didn't wear point shoes, they didn't wear tutus, they're girls, I know this, and the crocodiles had, like, capes, but capes are a genderless thing, but I automatically perceived them all as male.
They're males.
And I thought that was really strange. And like with the hippos and the ostriches, I can kind of understand because they're in point shoes and tutus and that sort of thing. But the elephants and the crocodiles shouldn't really be gendered in my head, but definitely are.
Well, the crocodiles end up dancing with / chasing everybody else.
It's true.
So they're they could just separate them. Well, they're clearly a separate entity than all the... There's these three, and then the crocodiles.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if you know, if you're going to start with the genders, like, everybody's got to fall into these rule sets.
I just thought that was very strange.
There's also that one... It's a tiny little moment, but there's a crocodile on either side of a pole, and one's pulling an ostrich out of one end, and one's pulling an elephant out of the other end.
And the whole chase scene, that was the only note I made, was LOL half ostrich, half elephant.
And it's a tiny little thing, but it's a defining moment of this, like, silly. And it comes to this conclusion of, they basically danced the palace down because it's we end up with the doors we started with, except now they're just, like, in shambles.
Oh, poor things. What a way to wreck a palace.
And so, but it's a nice start-up to Night on Bald Mountain.
Oh, man.
I love Night on Bald Mountain.
It's really good.
It is amazing.
The introduction for this really made me laugh, because he's talking about it, and he's like, so Bald Mountain is where Satan hangs out. He says it so just calmly, just not even phased, not like, so this is where Satan is, you guys. He's like, so Bald Mountain is typically where we talk about Satan. Oh, is that so? Well then, that's good. This as a kid did really freak me out. But watching it now, it didn't freak me out nearly as much as the dinosaurs.
No, the dinosaurs were shocking. But, oh man, it's... This was my favorite sequence as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but I really loved... I loved the animation. I loved the character of the Satan demon, who is a completely different. It's a gargoyle. It's not,
it's not like
the guy in red, horn and pitchforks.
Yeah, no pointy tail, that sort of thing. It's got big wings and horns, and he's like kind of dark looking and
it opens in the evening of this little town, and it's Bald Mountains in the background.
This nice little picturesque little town. It looks like a little,
it reminded me of the Pinocchio town, and it might be because we just watched that, but
it definitely looks like some sort of tiny little European town that's just kind of nestled by some mountains, all picturesque and cute.
In the background, there's this mountain that the top half turns into Satan.
You know, like you do.
At the beginning. And it's a very powerful character.
He's very large in scale.
Yeah, that might be because he's part mountain.
Yeah, that's a little intimidating.
But it's just, there's so much, and part of it's very much the music that is played around this character, but there's a lot of power given to this character, and the impression of how much power this character can wield. And there's not really a specific scientific scale, but this might be the most powerful character in, like, Disney storytelling.
Yeah.
At least up until this point, if not beyond. It's just the potential of evil to come from this character. And it opens up with, little shots of the town, and he kind of warps the town.
He sends out his fingers, shadowy fingers.
Yep, and I made a note. It's like, this is the town Tim Burton wishes he could draw.
It's true,
because it's
creepy. He sends out his creepy, shadowy fingers to all the little houses and all the little graves.
And we get the graves and the dead spirits start rising from the graves. The
souls start rising. Oh my goodness. And the souls are really interesting because a lot of them look like skeletons.
Skeletal. And
some of them are dressed, but they're really, like, the detail in them is really beautiful. It looks like they were done in maybe pastels. Like, the texture that they used was really interesting. Uh-huh. And the way that they animated them is very cool. They're, like, warped and I don't know how to describe
I know what you're saying. It was very interesting. Like, there is a scene where they're rising from a graveyard, but there's also a scene where they're rising from the moat.
Yeah. On the horses. Castle area.
And there's also this scene where they're coming out of a noose.
Yeah, that was area, creepy. There's a soul that just, like, goes through a noose.
Well, it's kind of clear, like, this is where these souls must have died, which is why you would show this. And the people that die from hangings are really serious criminals.
Yeah.
And so these are the souls that he's bringing back onto Earth.
Right.
And so, the souls in the moat probably died in some sort of battle.
Yeah.
You know, and
they're on the wrong side of perhaps.
Yeah, well, but it's not... You know, grandma who died at age 93 in her bed, baking some bread.
Nope.
So it's these awful, terrible souls that, you don't care to have back on Earth.
No. And then it pans back after he's done grabbing all his souls, it pans back up to the mountain there's all these little demon things, all these little monsters.
They're so weird.
They're so cool. This is really cool character design, you guys. I'm very impressed.
It was real cool. It reminds me a little bit of what would eventually become Maleficent, the demon
posse. Yeah, the little goblin dudes. It reminded me, actually, a lot of them look quite a bit like Pain and Panic from Hercules. Sort of slumped over stature to Panic? Is that Panic? Pain.
Pain, yeah.
And in the elongated nose and the pointy ears, they reminded me a lot of that. There's lots of demon-y guys.
And he grabs, like, this fire hand, and it turns into these naked dancing ladies.
Yep, scandalous. I was wondering when there was going to be, like, some sort of sexual indication there. It's like, it's Satan. We gotta have something sexy. Where's his, dancing fire leaves?
Well, what he does is, like, and then he squeezes it, and they turn into, like, these animals. Pig monsters.
Yeah.
And he's squeezing it, and they just turn into something else that's just demon-y awful looking.
And then he smishes them back, and they turn into fire again, and he drops it.
Yeah, and it's just this very much of, like, just cause.
Like, what you doing, Satan? Oh, nothing. Messing with fire, you know.
And, like, and then he just kind of throws them into this fire pit, like, these are so boring.
This is really dull now. I'm not terribly interested in this anymore.
And then it gets out of control.
Oh, my God.
And the harpies come out.
Harpies have boobs. Like, boobs harpies with nipples boobs. And everything. And I was like, man... That's weird,
like,
Disney.
I noticed that a few times throughout this movie, like, the centaur girls, second she walked out. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that's... Yeah.
But they, you know. A lot of times they had, you know, like, Sailor Moon-style nudity, where, like, they were naked, but there was really nothing there. But no, herpes were, like, super well-defined.
They did, but they were so, like, fast at the screen, yeah. And I'm so busy being like, oh my goodness, they're coming at me. Before, like, I have to think back and be like, yep, that was a naked lady.
Everything goes nuts, and then the church bells start to ring.
Yes, and it stops them, you know.
I'm sorry, but this just seemed really, really silly to me, because it's like, he's wreaking all of his havoc, he's pulling souls from the grave, and it's like a ding stops you. I know what they were going for, I get the symbolism.
And the thing is, musically, it's insanely beautiful.
It's really nice.
The transition, and when I was a kid and didn't listen to the narrator, I didn't know there was a transition. I didn't know I was listening to these two different songs. Yeah. I thought Ave Maria ended Bald Mountain, because you don't want to end a song in the middle of that insane craziness.
Apparently you do, apparently you do.
So, but they just, it segues so beautifully, and they go back, and there's this really pretty piece of animation where he turns back into the mountain.
Into the mountaintop, yeah.
And I rewatched it, and, like, I can't pinpoint, like, you know, gargoyle, gargoyle, mountain.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's a really that lovely line transition.
Is almost impossible to define.
Although that poor town, just chilling there with Satan perched all up in its mountain. Crap.
But I got us, and then we get this crazy beautiful long side pan of the procession of the faithful, which is all those, like, impressions of people carrying candles.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
It is, like, and it's
there's a lot of really pretty blue and purple tones in there that are just really, really pretty.
And it's this amazing shot, like, camera setup wise, which is, you know, not something you express a lot in animated film, but it's this beautiful, you know, pan that's tracking faster, and you can still see them moving, and they kind of move into this wooded area, which there's, like, a touch of a cathedral feel to it, but not this, like, overtly, like, this is religion now.
Religion, damn, go.
No. Which, and it goes through, and it ends on this, like, really pretty sunrise, which is, so, like, at that one moment, like, that's insanely hopeful.
I know, right? Like, did we just forget all of the things that just happened? But it's so pretty.
But it works out, because you can beat them, and the movie's over.
Yep.
And that's such an abrupt end.
I was kind of hoping for some narration at the end to be like,
I was expecting it.
I hope thanks, you really thanks enjoyed for coming. Fantasia. We liked working on it.
So
Or at least, like, you know, a bow from the symphony or something.
Yeah. Well, but there's I mean, what I was expecting, because I'm used to it, I was expecting credits. Yeah. Or some, you know, or some version of it, because earlier Disney movies didn't have credits, but they still had a the end card, which, you know, Fantasia didn't have. But yeah, that's kinda how, and, you know, once I got over the whoa, that's the end. Excuse me. Wait a minute. What happened there? It's a really nice way to end it of, you know, the sunrise on this, you know, very emotional 2 hours you just spent.
Basically, yeah.
So, but that's Fantasia.
Yep.
In a very extended nutshell. Well, the thing is, Fantasia is a 2-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only Disney movie to break 2 hours.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I went back and checked. It's, which, you know, is thus unusual.
Yeah.
For a Disney movie. And it's, and I got the impression watching this, and it's, there's so much passion being put into this movie.
Yeah.
And it feels like such a personal project for Walt Disney and what it mm-hmm. must have been for him to really want to make this different thing, and test he was testing the bounds of animation.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you could do with it as a storytelling medium.
Right.
And so I want to talk for a second about, it's, you know, it's fairly well known that there was this vision of more Fantasias,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't work out because Fantasia was not an initial success. And
which part is of depressing.
That, it is. It's, and part of that came through, it was released not in a movie theater format, but in a roadshow format where, you know, you would buy your tickets in advance and you would dress up and you would go to the theater for a night out. And it was like, and it had 2 shows a day instead of, you know, the several that a movie would have. And you know, you got a program to read through. And by the way, do you know how bad I want a program from 1940
bad.
Fantasia right now? That's like my big Disney memorabilia desire.
Lord knows how much they are on eBay.
Oh, man. But so, and that, you know, there was just this kind of, you know, poor communication of how that will resonate with people to be able to make back the money for Fantasia.
Yeah, especially for kids.
Oh, and by the way, World War II is happening still.
Oh, yeah.
So guess not going overseas into those theaters.
Yeah, no.
So, and also, he, by the way, kind of invented surround sound to make this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It was called, I think, Fantasound at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was trying to make an orchestra feel, and so this new sound. And so he's like, oh, theaters, you want to make this movie? Install this expensive sound equipment.
Probably not the best choice.
And so that kind of, you know, and it was such an ambitious thing. But there was this vision of Fantasia is a forever incomplete movie, and, like, you could right. add new segments to it, and you could take segments out. And so it's not every 3 years, here's 7 new segments, but it's, you know, here's some of the classical segments and here's some new segments we're trying out. Like you would go to a concert and
right.
hear these songs that you know, but here's a new song that we've been practicing.
Right, right.
And so, and it's, there's art from, he already had stuff planned. He had, I know he had Ride of the Valkyries.
Right, yeah.
Planned out, and there were some other ones, and there's existing art, you know, concept art and stuff for how these were going to work out. And so that's like a lost treasure of cinema.
But they did do Fantasia 2000.
They did Fantasia 2000, which is, you know, which we will get to weeks from now, like months from now,
next year sometime.
But yeah,
I think it'll be interesting to see the differences between the two and how well or not well, depending,
mm-hmm.
the legacy was carried on.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, like, it was a good idea, and it's a valid piece of entertainment.
Definitely.
That, and I think that must have, like, kind of hurt Walt Disney for a long time, because he had to know, like, he had an idea worth having with this, and it took too long to get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. It's a solid masterpiece.
It is. It's really beautiful.
And everything about it. And I do. I love the idea that this was such a passion project these people to create.
And you can really see how much work that went into it.
Yeah.
And how many long hours were involved with that animation.
Yeah. And so it's great. Now we're incredibly fortunate that we can watch it on DVD and be like, oh yeah, that is one of the best movies ever made.
Oh, quite so.
What do you know?
How about that?
There's one thing I discovered in doing some research for this movie in preparation on the DVD. So there's DVD audio commentaries, which is a pretty common thing, and then on some older movies they'll have film historians do an audio commentary instead of the deceased creators of the movie. But Disney actually compiled interviews that Walt Disney gave about Fantasia. And found, they transcribed a lot of the story meetings about Fantasia, and so they did readings of what Walt said in those meetings, and so they essentially built this audio commentary directly from Walt Disney Fantasia, which that's so incredible that they were able to make this a DVD feature, but that they were that. It was worth investing all that into a DVD feature for this movie because this movie is Fantasia and what Fantasia is. So
that's really neat.
I loved it. It's my favorite of what we've watched so far.
Me too.
By a long shot.
Yeah.
Although
it's like three.
Yeah, it's out of three. So that'll change, I'm sure. Just like every second, and it was one I was like, I want to watch parts of that again, like almost right away.
I would make everything into GIFs and put it all over Tumblr. That's all I want to do. Fancy fairy GIFs all over my Tumblr.
It was good, and it was nice to soak it in again.
Yeah, it's very much an experience.
Yeah, and so watch it and take the time that it deserves to. Sit down and watch it straight through and experience it and experience the music and experience the animation and for all of it, even Rite of Spring.
Even if it scares you.
Because it's insanely well done. And that's the other thing is it was such an ambitious project because when you kind of define some of this, there is, let's do a ballet parody. But at the same time, it's like, in the same 2 hours, I would like to, at one, detail the origin of the universe, and two, depict the ultimate struggle between good and evil in Nine on Bob Mountain, Ave Maria.
Sounds
and
legit.
I think that can all be done in 2 hours and with no words. Yep, that's what we're doing.
Go!
I'm like, that's such an ambitious thing to do and to pull it off with such perfection is... nothing short of stunning.
Yep.
So, watch it. Watch it now.
Yes, go. Now. We demand it.
Yeah. Next week, our next animated feature is going to be Dumbo.
I'm crying
which
already.
Is quite a bit shorter.
That's good.
Yeah, but we will see you next week to check out Dumbo and his little magic feather.
Yep. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.